Stuart Lee. Stuart Lee, hello.
Hello, thanks for having us in.
Listen, welcome back. It's always a great pleasure to have you here.
Thank you very much.
You know how much I enjoy your work.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, well, I come on enthusiastically knowing I'm going to be praised rather than blamed, so it's great. Right.
It also gives me, every time you come on, it gives me an excuse to sort of indulge in your stand-up and various other bits of your work in preparation for this. So it's homework that I enjoy.
Oh, great, thank you.
So your comedy vehicle is your TV series.
Yep.
And it's in its second series.
Yeah, it's on tonight.
It's on tonight on BBC Two at 11:20. And just to explain what it is, it's largely half an hour. There's a bit more to it, but it's largely half an hour of stand-up.
Well, it's mainly stand-up. It's all on one sort of theme, and it kind of got a beginning and a middle and an end. It's intercut with one short film item near the end every week, and with Armando Iannucci, the writer-producer of The Thick of It, interviewing me in a dark room as if I'm at fault in some way. So that's basically it.
Well, we're going to play sort of a clip of you doing stand-up from the show, from tonight's show. Is tonight's the second one?
Yeah.
From tonight's show. And we'll play a clip of Armando as well, talking to you as well. Well, it's an interesting dynamic. So you've got, there's you on stage doing your stuff.
Yeah.
And here's what I found fascinating about our last conversation. You said to me last time that what you do on stage, you're in character.
Yeah.
And I guess when you're talking to Armando, deconstructing what you've done on stage, he's talking to Stuart Lee,
well,
not the man in character.
No, sort of. I'm another character there, which is kind of me overstating the case for my own work, you know. But really, the thing was, after the last series, I noticed what people were saying about it, and people said, oh, it comes across as like he's an arrogant, sort of high-status figure. And I thought, that's interesting, because on stage it's not. Because on stage I normally can fabricate something in the room where it's going badly, or I let someone in the audience get the better of me. There's always something to sort of undercut it. But on our last telly show, it sort of wasn't that. So I thought, let's use Armando as this other voice who criticises me and complains about what I'm doing and says it isn't very good and stuff like that. So I think it's sort of a much more rounded programme now.
It's another level of deconstruction. One thing you do in your sets is you deconstruct. So the thing that I typically associate with you is saying, oh, that joke went down well in that corner of the room, but you didn't get it over there, did you?
And
in this TV show, you address the camera and say, if you're under 40, that wasn't for you.
There's
a lot of that. So this is yet another level of...
Yeah, well, I've had to move it on because there's loads of people on the circuit doing that, what you've just described now. So I've had to make it even more multi-layered and complex. So, yeah.
Yeah, perhaps next time you should have that. And then have you with Chris Morris deconstructing the chat that you had with Armando, which was deconstructing the stand-up that we've just seen.
Yeah, well, weirdly, Armando ended up doing the chat, but the chat was sort of the result of a week's conversation with Chris Morris, where we were sort of working out what sort of thing that chat should be and who's that character. And it's not clear in the programme whether he's a television controller or a journalist or, we were sort of thinking of it being a bit like something you might get in some kind of experimental play where someone's just kind of picked on by someone for an hour. So, you know, there's all bits of all of those people in there, I think.
And Chris Morris is, of course, the script editor on this.
Yeah.
So we'll talk more about him as well later. Let's play a clip. So here's a clip from tonight's edition of Stuart Lee's comedy vehicle, BBC Two at 11:20 p.m.
I don't know what it's like. I don't know what it's like where you are, where I'm all the middle-aged, middle-class parents. Are we leaving the city? We're going to the countryside. And they get to the countryside and they realise there's nothing to do in the countryside. They're absolutely bored out of their minds. Every day, the same thing. They walk out of the house and they walk to the field behind the house and they look at the horse that lives in the field behind the house and they go, oh, there's the horse. He's over there. He was over there yesterday. He's moved around. And they walk back to the house and they argue and argue and argue because there's nothing to do and the marriage starts to unravel and they look for some kind of distraction. But there isn't one because they live in the countryside. And in the countryside, you have to book 2 months in advance to get a table at Bella Pasta.
It's always quite hard picking clips from your shows because you you take your time.
Yeah.
With your material,
well, I mean, what I tried to do even more self-consciously with the series this time was to write it so that ideally it was impossible to pull anything out of it. I wanted all the bits to relate to each other, and you know,
that I couldn't clip it and internet.
Well, it's not just you. It's actually very difficult for the trails people, you know, and because they can't really. It's luckily no one's decided to trail it at all anyway. But had they done so, it's sort of really important. In the last series, I had. I had 5 lines in the last series that I didn't write. 3 were written by Simon Munnery and 1 was written by my wife. And 2 was written by my wife. They're basically one-liner gags. They're not my sort of thing. And it was always them that got pulled out for trails, you know, not my bits. So I don't have that kind of material.
Well, having structured your show so that it's difficult for people who make TV trail to find a clip for a trail, you can't really bemoan the fact that they haven't made a trail for your show.
No. Yeah, I can't. I've shot myself in the foot. But in a way, it's just because I felt like sort of culture's going the other way. And much as I can see the value of Twitter, I kind of think maybe the 140 character piece of information, you know, it's not necessarily the way everything has to head. So I thought I'd try and make a show that was much longer and more involved than anything I'd done before.
And are you pleased with it? You happy with the work?
Yeah, I'm really, really pleased with it. I think I keep my head down when I've done things, or I just see all the stuff in them that hasn't worked. But this is sort of what I've wanted to do for 25 years. This series, really, it's sort of really come together really well. I'm really pleased with it. So much so that I don't really sort of mind how it gets reviewed or what anyone thinks about it, because it's done. You know, it's great.
The first series was on, I think, about 10 PM, wasn't it?
Yeah,
and it had sketches effectively within it as well as a stand-up.
Yeah.
And this doesn't have those. And it's on at 11:20.
Yeah.
And that was, I think, deliberate, wasn't it? I wondered if it had been like a late bit of scheduling that you'd be annoyed about, but I noticed in tonight's show, whilst you're recording reference that the show's going to be on late.
Well, it wasn't decided for a year whether to recommission it, and then when it was, the understanding was that, you know, the budgets have been cut by about a third across the board on comedy. And that the new controller, BBC Two, wanted to sort of try and carve out this post-Newsnight slot where they used to put all the American imports like Seinfeld and Curb Enthusiasm and stuff, see if we could do anything with that. So it was written for that slot, you know. And at one point they offered me 10 o'clock in July on a Saturday. And I said, you know what, it might get more people, but when I wrote this, I very much had in mind it being 11:20 and it sort of being the end of the day and people being sort of tired when they watched it, or it being hard to find. You know, it sort of felt like it should be on at that time. So
quite a cool slot, isn't it?
I think it's great. Also, there's this whole weird thing going on now when, you know, on the one hand, it was commissioned for 11:20 and we're sort of very much thinking about what is it like to watch something at 11:20 at night. But then on the other hand, half the viewers now watch it at any random time of the day on iPlayer. So you've got all the BBC Online and iPlayer departments sort of saying, don't forget, you know, it can be on at any time of the day. So we made quite a funny trail about that.
And is it doing okay on iPlayer?
I think so. I think it sort of doubles its audience, basically.
Does it?
I mean, yeah, we were sort of saying, you know, 35 years ago, 30 million people watched Morecambe and Wise all at the same time, and it drew the country together in a massive act of togetherness. But you can all watch Stuart Lee's comedy vehicle alone at any time and be part of no national consensus, you know. But it's interesting that how that's changed.
It's 11:20 suits you because you have a very big following now, but you also have, I think, quite a committed following, and they'll watch you at 11:20.
Yeah, well,
I think
that's why I was sent out like a sort of sacrificial goat into this uncharted 11. The feeling that a poor view of fools might follow me into this slot, you know. It does seem to have worked. What I've noticed being around is that the people, you know, it seems to have thinned off the kind of people that drive past me in vans and shout abuse at me. They aren't watching it. Right. They sort of people that hate it.
And you got abuse, did you, after the first series?
Not really. I'm exaggerating, but I think it's sort of certainly doesn't seem to be the amount of people watching it that just hate it, because I think it's on too. If you don't stumble across it necessarily.
Huh? You would, to watch it at 11:20, you're making a very deliberate choice.
Yeah,
I think when
Teddy's
on at 10,
yeah,
there is a degree of flicking around.
You just flick around, yeah.
People go, what's this? Oh, he's been a bit rude, don't like him. There must have been a bit of that, people don't really get what you do.
Yeah, and just people are just infuriated by the sort of slowness of it and the lack of any obvious jokes. And actually, one of the things I did was, I was looking up something, and I found this just torrent of like people just hating me on internet message boards and
saying, look at them, Stuart.
Yeah, I know, but then I thought, well, I looked at them and I thought, well, I should do more of that stuff that those people hate, the long drawn out things and the stuff that seems boring, and, you know, try and sort of take it as a compliment almost.
That you've done the exact opposite of what a more insecure person would do, which is you look at the criticism and you think, oh, how can I placate these people? Well, you've gone, how can I rile them more?
Well, I started to find it funny because it was so disproportionate. You know, people saying that they hope you die and they'd like to beat you to death with a bat and things like that. And you kind of think, wow, it was only a joke, whatever it was. So
that's what internet forums are for. Therefore, wildly exaggerating your opinion anonymously.
Yeah, yeah.
If you confronted any of these people, they go, "Oh, God, sorry, mate, yeah. I didn't mean it. You know, sorry."
Well, it's a weird thing, though. I mean, it never. When I started stand up, you weren't sort of 20 odd years ago. You weren't subject to that level of analysis. I wouldn't want to be starting out now. I think it could really put you off your game. You know,
Comedy Vehicle is on now, and it's on tonight, 11:20. On BBC Two, also features Armando Iannucci, writer of The Thick of It and many other things, and Chris Morris, famous for Four Lines and The Day Today, is the script editor. So what is his contribution to your
show?
Well,
in the first series, he sort of helped me put all the film items together. This time, he just sort of talked about tone, really, and ideas, and it was really great having, you know, his brain to bounce that off. He did come up with one or two lines. One of them is one of the ones that I haven't written that would doubtless get pulled out everywhere, where I was sort of thinking of... I was trying to write a kind of parody of observational comedy, you know, where people notice things that everyone's noticed. And Chris's idea was that, have you ever noticed that whenever you see a fish tank in the dentist's or in a public waiting room, there's always a tiny statue of Napoleon in it. There's always a tiny... And it's really great, that, because you go, oh, yeah, there is. And then you think... it's one of those things that's just close enough to being... being possibly true to work really well. So he helped round off the edges of everything.
Is your point with that with a lot of observational comedy, it isn't actually really true?
Yeah, it isn't actually true. But then, so it was fun to try and make up things that sound like they ought to be, but aren't.
Yeah. Steve Coogan used to do that character, didn't he? Do you remember he did a bad stand-up comic?
Yeah.
Have you ever noticed?
Duncan Thicket. Early on, yeah.
That was it. I'm not saying you've in any way copied. That was not the implication,
no,
Stuart.
No, you know what? I was so naive as a young man. I saw that character on the same bill as Steve Coogan and didn't realise that it was him. And, you know, so where'd you get that guy from? He was mad.
The show, here's what's funny about the show. It's 3 hours, so it's 6 episodes, I think, isn't it?
Yeah.
So you've got 3 hours.
Yeah.
It is, there's a bit of you and Armando, but largely it's you doing stand-up.
Yeah, I mean, I had 3 hours of stuff on the go at Christmas before we recorded it. Yeah,
that is a hell of a lot of material.
Yeah, I mean, probably 20 minutes of it was old that I'd done, you know, before. But yeah, well I knew this was coming and I knew what the format was, so I started on it in May, and I've been doing gigs since May last year where I do kind of hour and a half, 2 hours a night, and in sort of half hour blocks. But what I'm doing in 2 weeks time, actually, on the 27th of May at the South Bank in London, I'm doing the whole 3 hours in three hour long chunks.
Is there a little break to get a break between each hour?
Yeah, for the last time ever. But I mean, in a way, sort of with me, I'm not looking for individual lines. I'm looking for a kind of like a locked groove that I can get into, you know, like and sort of improvise around. So it's not quite the same as one of those genius blokes like Tim Vine who would have to write
He'd
have to write about 900
because he'd
jokes.
Short one liners.
Yeah.
So this is we'll mention this again just before you leave, but it's the Austerity Binge, isn't it?
It's called
the South Bank Centre. And performing all of your material from the TV show.
Yeah, they let me program four nights there. And there's a particularly good one, the 29th of May. I'm co-hosting a show called At Last, the 1981 Show, where I've tried to put together the kind of bill of comics that you might have seen just before alternative comedy broke big. So we've got some people out of retirement, like
who?
Alexi Sale.
Yeah.
And Nigel Plain is doing Neil, the folk singer that he did in
Jimmy Cricket,
in the young one. No, not sort of different generation. And then things like The Greatest Show on Legs, that was the Naked Balloon Dance, and Arthur Smith doing it. And,
so these are people who
John
were alternative. They were kind of alternative comedians before they got branded alternative comedians.
Yeah, they
is
were.
That what
yeah,
you mean?
It's basically about. I mean, I just sort of thought it's so massive now, and sort of 30 years ago, you would never have thought that little mushrooming up of comedy would lead to sort of 25 date stadium tours, you know.
It is fascinating. I was looking at some stats about this. So in terms of, so comedians now typically play big arenas, which used to be quite a rare thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's quite an odd concept that a bloke on one microphone would stand on a stage in an arena.
Yeah, it is.
In 2004, 100,000 tickets were sold to see comedy in big arenas, and in 2009 it was more than 1 million.
Wow.
So it's a tenfold leap in 5 years.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I've seen you say in articles that is in a large part down to Michael McIntyre.
Yeah, I think Michael McIntyre's a sort of bridge between there's still a residue in what he does of alternative comedy and of, like, you know, the sort of
you admire him.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I don't know. It's a difficult thing to. It's not stuff I'd go and see, but I think to be able to be that popular without being awful is quite amazing, you know, because normally you have to sort of and I think it's interesting to see to see it work on that stage. I suppose the thing is what happens next. You know, if he becomes a sort of light entertainment personality, what will happen? But I think it's been really helpful for stand up. I think it's sort of made people think they might go and see it. On the other hand, I slightly worry that it also establishes an idea that it all has to be like that, and that if you don't do that, it looks like you've made a mistake. And that's sort of the thrust of this series, is to make people think I've made a mistake.
I wanted to come back to talk about when you were last here, and you were talking about what you said was. Yeah, but it was interesting. You, this thing about you being on stage and being in character. So there's Stuart Lee now in front of me. I guess you're not in character on the. This is you, right?
No, this is me. Yeah, yeah.
And then on stage,
and this is me. It's like Mike Yarwood at the end when he used to go do all his impressions and then go, and this is me. It was a slightly disappointing, strange, uneasy presence. That's what I am in real life.
No. Yeah. You said on stage you're in character, and on stage you will sometimes attack. So you say, you know, you quite admire Michael McIntyre, but on stage you'll attack him a little bit.
Yeah.
And like the Top Gear presenters. We played a bit of it at the start of the show today, that quite compelling bit where you talk about you don't know which of the three to despise the most.
Mm.
That's not really you talking.
Well, you know, I don't like what the political view that I imagine informs Top Gear, right? But on the other hand, it's when we had a budget for the program in the old days, and we were trying to do a parody of Top Gear, we realised there was just no way we could afford to, because the production values on it are so amazing and the way it's all assembled. So it's a kind of weird thing where you can separate those things out in your head. You know, you can admire something for what it's good at, whilst at the same time not really liking anything. You know, and not really liking anything about it. And I suppose on stage you choose a particular way to go. And one of the things I've found interesting as like comedy becomes more of a free for all, and it's not like 30 years ago where all the good comedy came from a broadly liberal perspective. It's much more varied now. I sort of think
Watch 10 o'clock live.
If you watch 10 o'clock, well, I don't know. Is it? I mean, yeah. Now, that was sat oddly on Channel 4, didn't it? I was quite excited by that when it came on.
It had an exclusively liberal perspective.
Yeah, it did. But then maybe things will swing now that you've got a now that you have a right wing government. I mean, I kind of don't really know. I don't really know where we are. The other day, I got asked if I'd do talk in a documentary being made by Katie Price about taste in comedy, and I thought, wow, we've got to a really strange position where that happens, you know. So I don't know. I mean, I think you take a position of things that you agree with, but you also take a position for comic effect sometimes.
Yeah, okay.
Not always the same thing.
So there's an element of exaggeration, I guess.
Yeah.
What you do on stage. I noticed a quote of yours as well. We were talking earlier about how big comedy is now, and this is partly down to Michael McIntyre. You talk about comics being in the slipstream of Michael McIntyre.
Yeah.
And you're concerned now that ambitious young people will try, so I'm quoting you, I think, will try to develop an act to fit a demand rather than creating demand for a new kind of act.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is true of how stuff gets commissioned anyway, isn't it? I mean, I always use this example. Like, TV commissioners try and commission what they think people want, right? And so those tend to be sort of copies of other existing hits or whatever. But, you know, the Mighty Boosh was a hit. And nobody would have thought that what people wanted to see was a pink sort of octopus with no body talking in a kind of exaggerated posh accent and flying around on a magic carpet. You know, if a member of the public was asked what they wanted to see, that wouldn't be one of the things.
Moon.
So I think we, you know, all creative people, all commissioners, everyone, you have to kind of try and do things that you don't know whether they're going to work and see what happens.
Well, it's an important point here as well, which is, the public, when asked what they want, will often get it wrong.
Yeah, or they say things that they already know, you know.
Well, there was a quote I saw in an article in a newspaper from, I think it was head of marketing for Burger King. Do you remember the fast food restaurants were under all that pressure to sell salads because of the obesity epidemic?
Yeah.
And Burger King commissioned this research and said to their customers, what do you want us to do? And all their customers said, they said to all the customers, do you think we should sell salads?
Mm.
And everyone said yes.
Yeah.
So they put salads on the menu and no one bought them.
Yeah.
And the marketing guy said, we asked our customers what they wanted. Turned out they lied.
Yeah, they lied. Yeah, well, there's an interesting phenomenon that marketing people have noticed, which is there's a huge pork pie shaped hole in British consumer surveys, whereby a lot more pork pies are sold than anyone will admit to buying. Which means basically it's men doing what I do, which is why your wife's not looking. You chuck one in the shopping trolley and you hope you can get it home and eat it before anyone's found out. Right? So there's like the people aren't entirely straight about what they want. If you were to say to me, what do you think a balanced diet is? It wouldn't be a pork pie every day. But that's what I would eat. Left to my own devices, that's what I would eat.
I guess people sometimes, when asked what they want, give a slightly more aspirational answer.
Yeah, you do. People do with tastes. I mean, you know, there's a good example of when they, you know, that brilliant film, Airplane, right? When that was first tested, right, on audiences, it got really low scores. And then it went out and it did really well. Because when people are asked for their opinion, no one wanted to admit to finding that kind of brilliantly stupid film hilariously amusing. But it is. But it doesn't fit in with people's idea of who they are.
Apparently as well, when you get, because they're put in these rooms, they're weird situations, that people do look at what each other are saying and reacting to. Yeah. And so it's a bit like 12 Angry Men. They slightly influence each other.
Well, you know what? A nightmare setup for stand-up for me is when you get to some sort of provincial town hall and they go, oh, it's table seating. And there's groups of 12 people in rings, right? Around a circular table, and always on that circular table there'll be someone who's kind of the alpha male of that group, and so all the laughter filters through that person. And normally the person who is the alpha male of a group hasn't got a terribly good sense of humour, because if they had, they wouldn't be the alpha male, they'd be the bloke making fun of him, you know what I mean?
Yeah, of course.
So actually that just kills a room for me, because the people I appeal to are not the they're not the person in charge of a group, they're the other people. And when the tables are in it, people sat in circles, it all goes through that person. It's really interesting.
That person is for Top Gear.
Yeah, that's the Top Gear team. Yeah.
Charles Payton has emailed, and he says, I was turned away from the first recording of Stuart Lee's new TV show.
I always have him turned away, that man.
because it was significantly overbooked. The bright-eyed young woman with the clipboard, who told me that I hadn't quite made it, offered me priority tickets to a recording of Mock the Week instead. As I trudge back to Dalston to catch my train, I'm sure the breathtaking inappropriateness of her suggestion and what Stuart might have thought about it must have brought a smile to my lips.
Well, you know what? What can you do? All that ticketing's handled by a company that's sort of farmed out with BBC, and I mean, it's not as bad as it was. 20 years ago, when we first did television, me and Richard Herring, you would get whoever was in the building, and so we'd get about 100 people that wanted to see Fist of Fun, and they'd fill up the recording of our comedy as a new rock and roll sketch show with people that had wanted to see Bruce Forsyth, and invariably it went quite badly in the room. So there's not, you know, I'm sorry the man was turned away. If he wants to contact me via my website, you've got an agent, I'll endeavour to compensate him in some way, but don't take that as opening the floodgates where millions of people now pretend that they were turned away from things.
No, well, his name is Chris Payton.
Chris Payton, I'll remember that.
Andy from Yule, Stuart Lee's comedy vehicle is indeed excellent. Fist of Fun, is that coming back? I have the originals. Have you not bought the rights to them and you're bringing them out on DVD? Is that
we did a series in the mid-90s called Fist of Fun with Richard Herring and Peter Bainham, who ended up writing the Borat film and stuff like that. And it's sort of, I don't know what happened, it kind of fell into a, it was before the DVD release age, and so we never got released by the BBC, and we just found out last year that it was in the room where they put things before they destroy them, along with things like all the Beatles appearances and the moon landing footage and stuff like that. So Richard Herring and a bloke called Chris Evans from Cardiff have sorted out buying it, and we're going to we've bought it off the BBC and we're going to release it ourselves, which means you have to stop downloading it illegally and buy it, because we've actually paid for it. But it will be out next year, I think, or even maybe at Christmas.
And so there'll be some extras on there and you'll do some new material.
Yeah, well, Rich has got... Rich is like the sort of... You know, he's like Bill Wyman was in The Stones, where he used to keep all the tickets. Rich Herring had, like, canisters of film. You know, this is back in the days when stuff was shot on film. He's got canisters of film of stuff that wasn't put into the programme. And he got all kinds of stuff and old scripts and things. So, yeah, it should be... If you're, like... borderline mentally ill, obsessed with mid-90s comedy, it'll be absolute treasure trove.
Haven't you and Richard Herring talked about doing a one-off gig together again to launch?
Well, I think we will. Yeah, I think we'll do a one-off gig to launch this at some point. Yeah, the double acting, when we did it, we did it sort of a lot from about 94 to about 98, and it was sort of based on a adolescent relationship, really, of power structure, and also on the fact that he was much fatter than I was. But now that power structure is reversed, and it's very difficult to know how to do the double act now, because it's two overweight middle-aged men, and there's no, you know, there's nothing funny about that. One of them has to be different to the other one. That's how double acts work. It doesn't really work now.
Just a couple of emails and texts to end on. This is Ian in Wandsworth. Can you let Stuart know that his last mailing list mail out was astounding? The never-ending list of bad reviews was hilarious.
Thank you very much.
Richard on the M6, can you pass on my praise and appreciation to Stuart Lee for his particular brand of comedy? And Ian in Bournemouth says, dear Richard, I would ask you to tell Mr. Lee that he is the best stand-up comedian in the country, but as criticism of his work makes him better and better, I'd be worried this news might ruin him forever.
Oh, great. So, oh, that's nice that they're keeping me on my toes. Good.
Let's just mention, so Stuart Lee's Comedy Vehicle is tonight, BBC Two, at 11:20 p.m.
Oh, and if you've got a red button, there's a bit afterwards where I introduce people that I like, and it's Paul Sinner tonight, who's really good.
Oh, he's great, Paul Sinner, yeah. He came on the programme recently, so that's tonight, 11:20, and then the Austerity Binge. People want to see you live doing all of the 3 hours from Stuart Lee's Comedy Vehicle.
Yeah, and there's the 1981 show as well with Alexis Sale.
So the South Bank Centre in London, Austerity Binge. What are the dates and what website?
Well, you can get the South Bank website. The 27th is me. On the 28th, I'm in a performance of John Cage, works of John Cage, that I'm doing the spoken word bit on. Then the 1981 show's on the 29th, and then there's a lot of music shows on the 30th and the 28th as well.
Great. Britain's best stand-up comedian, Stuart Lee, thank you.
Thank you very much.